Welcome back, Richard. It's good to see you this morning for this
Hey,
last day of
Curry.
March.
It's what? The last day of
Last
March?
day of March. The first.
No, it is. March. Tomorrow's the last day of March.
Yeah, well.
Today's. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're always a little step ahead,
You
right?
let away, you let our secret out. We recorded
I
this on the
know. I
30th, and
know.
it'll be
No, it's not a secret. I'm just. I got my days and days confused. How are you? You doing okay?
doing all right. We had a great time yesterday evening because we haven't said this on the podcast at all, but this past week marked the 10-year anniversary of our practice here in Lakeland, and
Right.
we started it in March of 2014, and here we are, March of 2024, and happy 10 years.
Right. Been an eventful 10-year period.
It has.
But good, but a good 10-year period.
I agree. I agree. So
So
now,
we're going to continue, huh? We're going to
yes,
continue from last week.
we are, because last week we talked about some of our concerns with education, and we focus on two primary things, right? We talked about the teacher shortage,
Right.
and how one of the assumptions we have is that there's a highly effective, qualified teacher in every classroom, and well, that just doesn't necessarily seem
Not
to
the
be
case.
the case.
Right. Yeah, there's a I'm sure that most people know about this, but education is really in a at a critical point right now. There is much going on in education today, far too many things to even make a list. But we have these concerns. We mentioned two of them last week. One of them was teacher shortage, and the other was efforts to reform education, because those have been ongoing for the last 50 or 60 years. But the teacher shortage is especially acute in Florida, because we have more, there are fewer people going into education, to study education, to become teachers. And at the same time, as with most other professions, the baby boomers are leaving. And so teachers are leaving in larger numbers, not only because they're retiring, they're reaching retirement age, but also because of dissatisfaction with the profession, with the job of teaching. It's become so much more difficult. I taught years and years and years ago when it was easy to teach. Today it's much more difficult. I'm not sure. I'm sure I'd have to be completely retrained in order to teach in today's classrooms. But Florida, not only are teachers leaving, but Florida has this rapidly growing population. So we are getting a double whammy of teachers are leaving and more people are moving into Florida. So the teacher shortage is more acute. In the county just west of us in Hillsborough County, where Tampa is, that county has 400 vacancies. Now you say, well, 400 vacancies. They had over 1,000 vacancies at the beginning of the year. They've been able to fill some. But that doesn't speak to that other issue of, does that mean all the other classes are covered by highly qualified teachers? And the answer is no. Some of them are covered by substitutes, permanent substitutes, people without degrees and credentials. So there are 400 vacancies, but not all classrooms are covered adequately.
Right. Yeah. And I like to point about the how fast the population growth is
Right.
booming here in Florida. We in just this small area that we live in, there's just a couple of elementary schools, but we within the past year or year and a half or so, the county approved the building of over 800 new homes,
Right.
as well as several large apartment complexes. And so one of the questions we keep asking is where are all the kids going to go to school?
You're going to need several school buildings to accommodate the, I mean, you're talking about thousands of people coming
Yeah.
in. The fastest growing county in the country is our county. Where are these kids going to go to school? But where are the teachers who are going to fill the classrooms?
Right.
So it's an acute problem. It's a huge problem in Florida. Second thing we talked about were efforts to improve education. And these started back in the 50s. And for about 25 or 30 years, the reforms were mainly about two things. One was we have infusion and inclusion. There was an infusion of money, the National Defense Education Act, to improve math and science education because the Russians were a little ahead of us in the space race. So we wanted to catch up. And so we had to produce more scientists and mathematicians. So the government made this massive infusion of money to build educational facilities, everything from preschools to graduate schools. And the second reform, major reform in those years was inclusion. And that's when we saw the separate is not equal, Brown versus Board of Education, where you can't have separate classes for Black students and white students because they were not equal. It wasn't equal education. Second, women came into their own with Title IX, women's sports, and also exceptional student education. So that's the inclusion part, that we included more people in educational opportunity. So we have the infusion of money, the inclusion of more students. This took a dramatic turn in the 1980s with a publication called A Nation at Risk. And it was a 48-page publication that said, we have a serious national crisis in our schools. And the other thing that happened is that teachers started to get blamed for the problem. It was that teachers said schools were not doing their job, but what it really came down to was that teachers weren't doing their jobs. And there was a huge shift in educational reform efforts that really began in the 1990s.
And it changed everything for the next, 20 or 30 years, where we went from, as you said, sort of this infusion of money and the inclusion of other groups of people that weren't as included, weren't necessarily included before, to high stakes testing and, all of these slogans and mottos that we've heard, teaching to the test and kill and drill and all of these kinds of things, where the goal wasn't really just to educate. The goal was, we have to get them to perform well on a particular test or on a particular skill so that schools would get the funding that they need, or that teachers would be paid what they should be paid. And it really created a really challenging and competitive, and I'm not using competitive in the good sense that, we usually use it in capitalism. I'm using competitive in the sense that we have what you and I have referred to in many podcasts as a two-tiered education system.
The what happened in the 90s and into the 2000s is that when teachers were blamed, then somebody had to step up to make sure the teachers were doing their job. That was the idea. And so we had something called teacher accountability, where we're going to make sure that every kid is learning these basic skills, especially in reading and math. Okay, so we're going to teach those skills and we're going to test those skills. And we tested them, especially in third grade.
And on the surface, that sounds fantastic.
But what happened instead was once you start teaching these skills, and especially when you test those skills, that's what the state test did, is they said, this is what's important. Well, most teachers, most schools began to teach to the test, because your students had to do well on this test. It didn't matter what they learned, they had to do well on this test. And so schools began teaching to the test. Well, when they did that, it was teach skills, teach skills, teach skills, teach skills. And schools became deadly dull. They became boring. You couldn't go on field trips. We did away with recess. We did away with PE. We did away with all the special classes. Certain subjects weren't even taught until late in the year, like social studies. So education was distilled to the teaching of these very discrete facts. The other problem that occurred was, if your school scored high, if your students scored high on the test, you were given more money. You were rewarded with more money. Well, the high performing schools with high performing students got more money, but the low performing schools with low performing students didn't get money. So the very buildings that needed the money were denied the money. And this is called the Matthew effect, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The good schools got very good and had an infusion of money, and the teachers shared that, and they got bonuses because their students did well. And the schools with underperforming students didn't get anything. That demoralizes people. It sounded like a good idea at the time, but it was a government policy from the top down that had nothing to do with education. It rewarded some teachers at the expense of other teachers. The teachers who were working the hardest with the lowest performing students didn't get a bonus. The teachers with the highest performing students got a bonus. It just didn't make any sense. And so these top-down reforms of we know best, we know how to improve education, we in government know how to improve education. These were catastrophic. I think now we look back and say these were catastrophic failures. Okay. Most of the reforms of the 90s and 2000s. So that was the second thing we talked about was reforms. But we want to introduce one more thing today, and that is the plight of today's classroom teachers,
Absolutely.
because everything is different today. When we talk about all these other things, it was before the internet, it was before cell phones, it was before technology, it was before the pandemic. Today is completely different, and today's teachers face a completely different set of challenges.
And I think in many ways, with it where it is today in regards to those things, it is in many ways to blame. We can blame the last 30 years, the last, since the 90s, what we've done, because it's as we've said many times before, it's not just that we have electronics. It's not just because we have cell phones and all that kind of stuff. Schools have become boring. They've become, nobody's really, there's not very many people really having fun at school. And if you think about teaching to the test, all those things you just talked about, it makes school very rote and very not, for a long time, I remember they took some of the creative parts out of school, where they were taking out art and PE and recess. They're removing all of those things from schools, and some schools still don't have some of that, some of those extracurriculars, which makes school less appealing to students. I mean, students don't really want to be there, and so student discipline is, my goodness, I've never seen or heard of the disciplinary problems that we're having now. It's pretty unbelievable. And what is anybody doing about it?
That's right. We have all these discipline problems, but who has come up? Who's addressing these problems? The teachers are saying, I send a kid out of my class and he comes back in, and I send him out and he comes back in. Nobody's really dealing with these things. And then we have parent attitudes. Teachers know that they're going to get blamed. If there's a problem, the teacher is probably going to be in trouble. Somebody down the line is going to say something about the teacher.
Absolutely. Well, and let's not forget just about the student attitude in general. Parents will very quickly today, I mean, there's so many memes available that you can see where about how parents now blame the teachers instead of looking at the child for not doing their schoolwork. They blame the teacher for the kid not doing their schoolwork. Even the students have a different attitude, and they see it as almost like, I'm here for you to entertain me. I'm here for you to engage with me, and I'm a customer, and you just aren't doing it for me right now, so I'm not really going to pay attention, or I'm not really going to do what you're asking. And students are overtly denying or refusing or just not participating in what's happening in the classrooms.
That's right. Yeah, they've dropped. So you have these deadly dull, boring lessons of killing. It is boring. I mean, school is not fun. When I dropped my kids off at school, as they walked onto school property, they had to walk through this gate. When they walked into school property, they had to stop talking. And they could go to a place and read until the bell rang, but until they waited for school to start so they could go to their homeroom. They weren't allowed to talk. Silent lunch. They'd go to lunch and they weren't allowed to talk. Okay. there's probably good reasons for a lot of these things, but it together made school very dull, very boring, not a place where kids wanted to go. Okay.
Right.
And so the other thing was happening is that schools are our mental health facilities for children. There are no hospitals, there are no programs for children with mental illness. They go to school every day. Okay. So now schools are being asked to do that. So teachers are completely aware that they don't have confidence, public confidence. They don't have parental support, and they're aware of that. They also know that what they think and what they believe and what they need doesn't matter to the decision makers. They know that their voices have been silenced. Okay. So the question becomes, is anyone addressing the plight of today's teachers? And when we pose that question, there's only one starting point if you're going to improve education. One is, does it help teachers to be more effective? I mean, if you're not helping teachers, I don't care whether you're talking about a sports team or it doesn't matter, a factory. If you don't help teachers to be more effective, is this going to help teachers become more effective? And the second question is, does it improve education for all students? It's easy to educate some students. The problem is, in this country, we want to offer a high quality education to all students. And so does the reform improve education for all students?
And the big push for reform since the 90s or so have been this shift towards what we call school choice. And in school choice, people have proclaimed that school choice will fix education because it lets parents choose what school that they want that their child go to. Instead of going to their neighborhood schools, they can choose what school they want and what within the district or within a particular range. So when you look at what that has meant, that has sort of led to, yes, parents having some choice. It's led to the voucher systems that we see. It's led to, as we'll talk about in a moment, charter schools and magnet schools and things like that. But we have to ask, let's look at what parents are actually choosing. What kinds of schools are parents choosing to have their kids go to? And, some choose faith-based education. There's a fee and a cost to that, but some are choosing that option.
That's right. Yeah,
Other,
but and that's
oh,
legitimate. Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, people have been sending their kids to Catholic schools and Christian schools and Jewish schools forever. I mean, it's hundreds of years since the Industrial Revolution. Parents have opted to send their children to a parochial school rather than a public school because they wanted a religious-based, faith-based education. No problem with that. They paid tuition, they paid extra, and because they wanted their kids to get that. For most parents, however, it's not a faith-based decision. What they're choosing is they're fleeing, they want to get out of a low-performing school that has disruptive students, and they're seeking schools that have an orderly environment where their children can learn. When we talk about school choice, you're not choosing a science academy. You're not choosing, we have one art school. In our, well, now we have two. We have one, we have this Harrison School of the Arts, okay? And many parents want their children to go into the arts, and they're choosing that school for good reason. But that's also a high achieving school. Those kids are, they're serious students, they're serious teachers, everybody's goal oriented. That as works.
Yeah, and it's a highly competitive school. You have to put together a portfolio and apply to get in there, and they have to choose whether or not you have the skills and the wherewithal to be able to go there.
And if you don't, you're asked to leave. You can't
Right.
stay there. So you
Right.
have to continue achieving and behaving. You can't be a behavior problem in that school because they can't tolerate misbehavior because it's getting in the way of the education that they're trying to get. Okay. So that's the one exception. In most cases, but so the first question we have is, okay, I'm going to choose a high performing school. Now the first question becomes, Why are there low performing schools?
And you and I have talked and written about this for many, many years now. You can have two schools, two elementary schools, say within 1.5 miles or 2 miles of each other, and one can be what they call an A school, where all the students are performing at this very high level. Then you can have the other school that's a, we'll say a D school, where students are struggling and there's a lot of problems and teacher morale is low and all these difficulties. Why is there such a difference within 1.5 miles of each other?
That's the first question. Why do you need to flee a school? Well, because the school's underperforming. Well, the problem is not that you, the solution, if the problem with education was that parents can't choose, then school choice would be a solution. The problem that we're solving is that we have low performing schools. Now, the question, why do we have low, who's tolerating low performance? Why are you putting up with this? If you're a governor, if you're a lawmaker, if you're a mayor, if you're, no matter what your place is, who is tolerating low performing schools?
Well,
And who's doing anything about them?
right. And how, why is it that we think that taking some students, and if we're very honest, usually the students that are taken out of those low performing schools to go to another school are not the low performing students. Those tend to be the students who are strong because the parents are saying, look, he could do so much better. She could have such higher grades. She really wants to be, so we take him or her out of this low performing school and put them in another school. How can we, who believes, who has the idea that if we have a low performing school and we siphon off these stronger students and put them into higher performing schools, that's going to make the lower performing school better? Like, who thinks that? Where is the logic with
Who's where? Yeah, where's the improvement? Well,
So you still have
how
hundreds
does
of kids who go to that school who are still going to a low performing school.
right? It leaves those kids, it leaves most of the students in a low performing school. Okay,
Those
so
tend to be students who need additional resources, but then they
right.
can't get them because they're at a low performing school.
So choice makes some schools better. The schools that are already good get to take more good students in. So those schools do better. Choice makes education better for some students. It doesn't make education better for the students who don't get selected. And choice helps and supports some teachers. The teachers at the high performing schools have plenty of resources, plenty high morale. We're doing great. Everything's good. It leaves those teachers in the low performing schools with fewer resources and more students with special needs. So to me, this the whole idea of choice, creating choice, but the problem is create if I get up and I make a speech and I say, we're going to give parents a choice. You get to choose.
Oh, that sounds great.
That is massively easier than me getting up and saying, I am going to work with you to make our low-performing schools better. Okay, that's a much steeper climb. We've been battling that for 50 years. And now, instead of making low-performing schools better, we're simply going to give parents a choice so they can send their kids to high-performing schools. So the first question is, why do we have low-performing schools? And the second question is, if a school can be high performing, why can't all schools be high performing?
And it's so interesting because a lot of people will say, well, it was the pandemic that did this. And what the pandemic did was the pandemic sort of lifted the curtain and put a spotlight on things, because I think that there's a lot of people out there who do not truly appreciate the lives that many of our citizens, our community people live in. And I will never forget, because I was working in the schools during the pandemic, I had two elementary schools, and one of the elementary schools, performed a bit better. Very similar, they had very similar populations, but that school tended to perform a bit better. But the other school, they did not have the opportunity to shift to a purely online form of education. Everybody else went virtual. That school couldn't, because a huge percentage of students at that school did not have internet at home.
They didn't have internet, they didn't have computers.
And so, like, it's really important for people to hear that. They didn't, all of those students, or a large portion of those students, didn't have internet at home. When a teacher assigns a project that they have to do, when they assign something that they, and they say, just research it, go online and research, what happened in, the 1800s in the West. Okay. You have to, they don't have the internet at home. They can't do that. But then they get in trouble for not doing their homework, but they didn't have the resources. So we had some families that were going up to McDonald's in an attempt to get, internet somewhere.
Internet access, right?
But
And some kids working, they would work on a cell phone because that's the only access they had. They had to go someplace, had an internet access, they could use a cell phone, and that's how they're doing these assignments.
if they had enough data to be able to. So it's, like you said, it's not really fixing the problem that we have underperforming schools to say we have school choice, because we're still leaving schools as low performing schools and we're not helping them.
Now, what forms of school choice do we have? So, because we have some, let's see how they're working. Let's talk about magnet schools. Magnet schools originally were meant to attract, like a magnet, students to them because there was something of value there. We have when I was in Austin, when I was in Austin, Texas. There was a science academy, and we considered putting our son in the science academy. It wasn't any different than any other school, except that they specialized in science. His local school was perfectly okay. We weren't running from a bad school, a low performing school. We were simply considering going to this school because of what it offered. What we have here is students were supposed to be attracted to this school because it offered something special, but that's not what happened. What happened was we had education by lottery. If you won, wasn't there a show called Waiting for Superman or something where these kids were sitting in a gym hoping that their number would be called so that they could be selected to go to the school? And if not, they had to go to these low performing schools. They were left behind. So here we are, we're the wealthiest nation in the world. And if you get the golden ticket, if your number comes up, you get to go to a high performing school. But if you don't win the lottery, if you don't win the school lottery, you have to go back to your low performing school. This is the United States. We're not a third world country where we have limited resources. Why should we have education only for people who win the lottery? Win the ed you know, oh yeah, you got we only have 100 places. Well, we have 800 applicants. Well, we gotta have a lottery. So only 100, and then the other 700 have to go back to low performing schools.
And well,
So
in the Harrison school that you mentioned earlier, that is the model that you would think of with a magnet school, where they're supposed to attract students because of particular skills or particular interests, like you said, with science, and we have here with the arts. And so you have to demonstrate some additional skill or strength in that area, and then you can go to that school. But you're right, the magnet schools here did not do that. They did not. And so anybody, or many people who knew that there was a possibility to put their name on the lottery in the first place to be able to go to that school, pushed and tried to find any way that they could to skirt the system so that they could get their kids in these schools. And they were strong schools. They became high performing schools because, A, they got the strongest students, because they went
With
through.
your most involved parents,
But they also are strong because they have a selective retention. And that's getting a little bit better, to be honest. It's getting a little bit better. But if a student is going to that school and is raising too many problems, is creating too many issues, they're making poor grades, or they have too many behavioral issues, then they're asked to leave. They have to get back to their home school.
That's right. If they're too disruptive, if they're not working at grade level, you have to leave. So it wasn't selective retention. Admission, you didn't have to take a test to get in, but they had selective retention, and these schools became private academies with an accelerated curriculum. But heck, anybody can teach the best and the brightest. I mean, the teachers who taught in those schools had the best and brightest students in the county.
Right.
So their job was infinitely easier because if a kid was misbehaving, they just counseled them out of the school. You can't be here because you're getting in the way of education. So the magnet schools essentially were transformed. They metamorphized into private academies. Okay. The other example was charter schools.
Right.
Originally, the way charter schools were sold was we're going to have these charter schools that don't have to follow strict state education guidelines so that they can experiment with alternative approaches. So that then those alternative approaches can be exported to the public schools. The public schools couldn't because they were restricted by state regulations. So we said, let's build these charter schools so that they can do things experimentally that we can use to make the public schools better. That's not what happened. The charter schools, many of them, not all, many of these charter schools became essentially like magnet schools. They became high-performing academies. That they again had that selective retention policy. Now, again, not all did that. There's
Right.
a charter school here in our county that does a wonderful job with special needs kids.
Right.
They ultimately have that ability to say, this really isn't a good fit. Or the family says, this isn't really working, and so we'll take our kid out. But charter schools are not doing what they were originally designed to do.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned this a second ago, what choice does, regardless of how it's done, whether it's done with magnet schools, charter schools, or vouchers, what choice does is it exacerbates and accelerates what we've always had, which is a two-tiered school system. All right.
Right.
Years ago, it was segregated schools, and the black schools were never as good as the white schools. I mean, and that's why we had Brown versus Supportive Education, was to end that two-tiered school system. It was based on race. And so what choice does is that it not only it just maintains and ossifies and exacerbates the two-tiered school system, because what we're creating now is a bunch of top-tier high-performing schools,
Right.
and we're leaving behind all those kids who can't perform, who don't win the lottery and don't win a place in those high performing schools. So we have
Absolutely.
a two-tiered school system.
Absolutely. And it looks like we're probably gonna have to do a third third podcast in this vein, because we need to talk about whether any of this makes anything better for anyone. And that calls for a little bit more attention, because we could do three podcasts on the two-tiered education system. We've talked about it for over a decade now, and it's concerning because it seems and feels as though it's only getting more exaggerated. It's only feels
And I think that's what it's, and I think that probably this place where we introduced this idea of a two-tiered school system is probably a very logical place to end today, because that's really the problem we have to solve is why do we have these underperforming schools?
And it's one of the main causes, one of the main contributors to that plight of that teachers are experiencing right now, because especially those teachers who are in, who are not in those really high performing top tier schools, the other teachers, the teachers in all of these other schools, which are the majority of the schools, are
90%.
really struggling. They're really struggling, and nobody's really listening to them. Everybody comes in and blows smoke and and whitewashes and just makes things look good and makes things sound like they're going great and that all these resources and things are available. And they're simply not. They're
No,
just not there.
no,
They're
they're
not
not.
available.
And so the plight of today's teachers, we're not addressing that. School choice doesn't solve the problems that our teachers are facing today at any level of education. So that's what we want to talk about that. We'll come back to this next week. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. So, all right.
Good.
Well, so that will be our first podcast of April,
April.
2024. So until then,
Good.
stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.